The court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, McCann versus Nielsen. Mr. Tuohy.
May it please the court, my name is Timothy J. Tuohy, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Patrick McCann. Mr. McCann was shot in the chest by a deputy sheriff and subsequently filed a Section 1983 action for excessive force. While the Section 1983 action was pending, he went to trial on two misdemeanors, one of which was obstructing a police officer by failing to follow his verbal commands when he was told to stop, and the second offense was aggravated assault in that he committed a simple assault, which was then enhanced from a Class C misdemeanor to a Class A misdemeanor because the individual was a police officer. Judge Holderman set a discovery cutoff date of September of 05 and a date for dispositive motions in June of 05. In January of 05, before discovery started, the defendant moved for a protective order, stayed discovery. We filed a Rule 56 motion asking for leave to take discovery. They filed a motion for a protective order, which was granted for the purpose of submitting a qualified immunity defense. They did that, and they also raised a defense under Heck versus Humphrey requesting judgment on the pleadings, and the judge granted that. Our position on this case and the error which I think the district court committed is the district court did not bother or allow the parties to develop a full factual record. What he did improperly was he took the generic allegations of the complaint, the notice pleading, general allegations, and compared those to the generic offenses that were charged.
Now, you argued that the language at the end of paragraph 6, the so as to justify the use of deadly force by the defendant language, modifies everything that comes before it in that paragraph. What I need to know is if you made that argument to Judge Holderman.
Yes, we did. I raised that and also the following sentence, which said, there was no justifiable reason for using deadly force on this individual. One thing that's significant, and I think that would be one of the necessary results if this case were affirmed, is what I call the Little League coach exception. Illinois identifies aggravated assault. There's 17 different categories. You commit an aggravated assault if you're an irate parent and you go up to a Little League coach and start screaming to him because you didn't like the strike that he called on your son. The Little League coach can pull his weapon and then shoot you and kill you, presumably. And this is what Judge Holderman did. And he's justified if you say, or if the parent was convicted of aggravated assault. And that is the non sequitur in this case, and that's what I believe in Heck, in the case Brengtese or Brengtese, which was decided by this court in September of 05, which was 4 months after Judge Holderman issued his opinion in this case. And that case, a correctional officer was attacked by an inmate, and the inmate was convicted and given 3 years for aggravated battery. And this court said the fact that he was convicted of aggravated battery does not mean that there can't be excessive force. And I have been able to find no case in this circuit in which that decision was reached without some sort of factual development in which you look at the underlying facts of the conduct that gave rise to the criminal conviction. The one case that I think that may or that was decided on the Rule 12b-6 was Nolan, and in that case it had to do with a procedural defect in the extradition process.
What's the relevance of the allegation in paragraph 5 of the complaint that Mr. McCann was lawfully present?
Well, that he wasn't a trespasser. He was walking along the railroad tracks. Wasn't charged with trespassing.
Yeah.
And the conviction that on the misdemeanor for obstructing was because the officer said stop, and he didn't stop. So that was simple disobedience to a verbal command. And what the defense is saying, and Judge Holderman is saying, is when you don't obey a police officer's verbal command, I guess he's justified in using deadly force and shooting you in the chest.
You know, as Deputy Nielsen's attorneys pointed out, you had time after Mr. McCann was convicted in state court and before the court entered judgment on the pleadings to seek leave to amend the complaint and eliminate any heck problems. So I'm wondering why you didn't do that.
Well, as I pointed out, Your Honor, the discovery schedule and dispositive motions weren't going to occur for 6 months and 9 months. And as this court has said in Moriarty, that the discovery process is something that will help you winnow out theories. And had I known the judge was going to do that and not allow us to conduct discovery and make a decision, I would have followed the rules of fact pleading and made specific factual allegations in which I would have laid out the fact that he was convicted, but that he was shot in the chest before he was arrested. And those would be the factual allegations I would make if I wasn't following federal notice pleading and I wasn't abiding by the court's discovery schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Tuohy. Ms. Elk?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Elizabeth Eckel. I'm here on behalf of Deputy Nielsen. Counsel continues even today, as he argues to you, to minimize the convictions for which his client, or the offenses for which his client was convicted. We stand before you with the sole issue of whether or not those convictions, whether or not the complaint necessarily implies the invalidity of those convictions. And I think by his argument, he continues to try to diminish the conduct which his client acted in during the course of this interaction with the officer.
You know, there's a key issue, and I did not see a response to the argument that Mr. Tuohy made in your brief. So here it is. It seems to me that the significance of the language at the end of paragraph 6, the so as to justify the use of deadly force by the defendant language. Mr. Tuohy says that that clause modifies or limits all of the language in that paragraph so that what he is alleging is that even if Mr. McCann was resisting Deputy Nielsen or posing some sort of threat of violence, his behavior was not so egregious as to warrant the use of deadly force. And the issue, it seems to me, is why isn't that a plausible reading of 6?
First of all, I would disagree with counsel that he made this argument in front of Judge Holderman. Secondly,
well, we'll see that, won't we?
Certainly.
Somewhere in the record.
Certainly. Secondly, the way that that statement is posed in there, it is listed as almost an alternative set of facts. Mr. McCann, at the time that his complaint was filed, was aware of these facts. He certainly is entitled to, in a regular course of proceedings, to undergo fact discovery and amend his complaint to allege facts that he was not otherwise aware of. Here, he's alleging specific facts that he was aware that he did, in fact, act in. When he claims that he was not attempting to resist, escape, or defeat an arrest, those are facts that he is aware that he did, in fact, commit. And to say that he needs to wait until some later point in time when, according to the district court's discovery schedule to wait to amend his pleadings is disingenuous. Those are facts that are not going to come out during the course of discovery as to whether or not he committed those things. Those are things that are known to him not only at the time of his original filing, but most certainly at the time that he was convicted.
Let's stick with six, because I think that's the most important issue, as I said, in the case.
Okay.
If you read everything in the first part of that paragraph as modified or limited by the clause at the end, in other words, that he wasn't posing a threat of violence so as to justify the use of deadly force by the defendant, and he wasn't resisting arrest so as to justify the use of deadly force by the defendant, in that case, McCann appears to be alleging that however unlawful his conduct may have been, it was not of a character that would justify the use of deadly force against him. And that would be a perfectly acceptable way to make an excessive force claim that would be consistent with Heck. In other words, he wouldn't be challenging the fact that he assaulted and resisted Nielsen. He would simply be saying that Deputy Nielsen grossly overreacted by employing deadly force, shooting him in the chest. I mean, it seems to me that the language of paragraph 6 is admittedly somewhat ambiguous. But at the pleading stage, doesn't McCann get a favorable reading of his complaint? In other words, one that consistently with Heck doesn't call into question the validity of his underlying convictions.
The problem with reading paragraph 6 in that manner is that you have to completely disregard not only the remainder of paragraph 6, but also paragraph 5, where he indicates that he's lawfully present. In the context of the fact that
I don't understand the relevance of the lawfully present language to a Heck analysis. He wasn't convicted of a crime like trespass, which would presume that he was not lawfully present at the location where Deputy Nielsen encountered him. I mean, if his conviction were based on his refusal to follow an order that he move along, then maybe, you know, his allegation that he was lawfully present could be viewed as inconsistent with the conviction. But I gather that his conviction for resisting a police officer is based on his violent refusal to cooperate with the effort to arrest him. So I just, you know, the relevance of that lawfully present language just escapes me. I don't get it.
Well, it would be our argument that he was not lawfully present at the point in time when he was obstructing Deputy McCann's efforts to arrest him and when he was committing an aggravated assault upon Deputy Nielsen, that when you read those two paragraphs in connection with each other, it is a far reach to say that the only... even reading it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, to say that the only applicable portion of that is that he was not otherwise acting so as to justify the use of deadly force. I don't think that carving out that one portion is a reasonable way of looking at the complaint, even taking it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And I would direct your attention to the Okoro case, where there were allegations made in by the plaintiff in that case, and the court specifically rejected the notion of making that, taking the theoretical possibility that that was presented by the plaintiff. And here, in order to believe that he was not otherwise acting in such a manner as to use deadly force, Your Honors would have to make that same stretch and would have to believe that he was engaging in conduct that after he commits this obstructing a peace officer and after he commits an aggravated assault, that he's placed under arrest, and then it is at that point in time that the officer shoots him.
Did you get a look at Van Gilder?
Yes. Yes.
How are you going to deal with that?
I don't believe that case is similar to this case in that once again, the acts of that formed the basis for the conviction were separate and distinct from the acts which formed the excessive force claim. And, and if you read plaintiff's complaint, he does not make any distinction. It's one and the same. He claims that he's lawfully present at the time that all these acts occur, and he explicitly denies any wrongdoing whatsoever. In that case, the acts that formed the basis for the conviction had completed, and the plaintiff admitted that they had, in fact, committed the acts that formed the basis for the complaint, but then went on to say that despite that, the excessive force was unwarranted. In this case, plaintiff doesn't do that. He doesn't admit the underlying allegations. He doesn't of his convictions. He simply says they didn't happen, and then says and the use of deadly force was not warranted. And I don't think that you can get to the second part of that and still have him deny that he committed the acts that formed the convictions.
Why judgment on the pleadings in this situation? Aren't these motions usually raised on 12b-6 and leave to replead granted? I mean, there was a way to plead this case so that it would come out the way Van Gilder came out, right?
Certainly, certainly. And the plaintiff was given plenty of opportunities to do that. He first filed his complaint in October 8th of 2004, and he alleges that he had a basis for filing it the way that he did because he still had his criminal trial pending. Even accepting that as true, a year passed, he was convicted. The judge gave him until December 30th, which was over 60 days, to amend his complaint. He failed to do that.
Was he still within the time to appeal his criminal convictions?
Yes. I'm sorry. He was outside the time. He had 30 days from the time of his conviction. So 30 days from October 8th to appeal his conviction. He was outside the box for that.
And he didn't appeal?
He did not.
Okay.
So at that point in time, it was our belief on January 14th, we were still standing with the same complaint. Nothing had changed since the point in time when he had been convicted. He's still denying the fact that he committed the acts that formed the basis for the conviction. And so, therefore, that's why we filed that particular type of motion. If I could, I'm just sorry, add one more thing. It wasn't until, even after we filed that motion, counsel did not seek to amend the complaint. It wasn't until after that motion was denied and judgment had entered that he then, at that point, attempted to amend the pleadings.
Thank you, Ms. Elton.
Thank you.
Mr. Tuohy.
One telling point that was conceded by the defendant here is she reiterated, his conduct, which gave rise to the convictions. And that's the problem here, is nobody ever looked at the underlying conduct, and that's what has to be done. On page 6 and 7 of the appendix, Judge Holderman even said, we don't know what conduct he committed that caused this misdemeanor conviction. Could have been one, it could have been the other. We don't know. And that's the most telling point. He was looking at the generic misdemeanor criminal offense rather than the underlying conduct. With respect to the Okoro case, Okoro was much different. That was a case, as you pointed out, Judge Sykes, that there had been a developed record. Almost every single one of these cases had factual records, and in Okoro's case, he had given a deposition and steadfastly argued that he was being framed for selling drugs when that was what he was convicted of. The other thing that I believe is objectionable here is the defendant, and apparently Judge Holderman, is not being faithful to the requirements of notice pleading. Moriarty and that whole line of cases indicates that the defendant on a 12b-6 or a judgment on the pleadings has to prove that it is impossible under any set of circumstances to prove that the plaintiff cannot prove his case. And here we are parsing the different portions of the complaint as we would do in fact pleadings, for example, in state court. Of course, had I known they were going to do that, I would have made factual allegations. It wasn't necessary to amend the complaint because under Moriarty, that case holds that you can amend or expand the allegations of the complaint based on affidavits or in your briefs, which were done. And I believe that Judge Holderman even conceded that the factual allegations that we made relative to the underlying criminal convictions were really not relevant to his decision. He says that in a footnote in his original memorandum opinion, that it doesn't make any difference. I can compare the offense with the general allegations. So you have a generic offense compared to generic allegations. And that's not how heck is supposed to work. It's fact intensive. Let's look at the conduct. If the conduct that he needs to prove to prevail on a Section 1983 action, does that cause his release from prison or invalidate his conviction? How can we possibly determine that without looking at the underlying conduct? So unless you have any questions, I believe this case should be reversed for the purpose of a development of a full record. Maybe ultimately it can be decided on a full factual record. But Mr. McCann at least deserves that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tuohy. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.